You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House and I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up, tensions rise on Capitol Hill as investigations into Donald Trump's dealings with the Kremlin turn to his son-in-law.
Some administration officials are saying, well, that's standard procedure. I don't think it's standard procedure prior to the inauguration of a president of the United States by someone who is not in an appointed position. And I think that Mr. Comey, we now know, took action that he did in regards to then-candidate Clinton because of some false news that was being put out by the Russians.
U.S. Senator John McCain adds more doubt to the many questions continuing to pile up over the extent of the relationship between Presidents Trump and Putin. We'll also look at today's Ukrainian peace talks in Berlin, assess the FARC disarmament deal in Colombia, and we'll look back at the politically tumultuous life of former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Jacob Parakilis, Assistant Head of the US and Americas Programme at Chatham House, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, a reader in law at Birkbeck here at the University of London. Jacob and Oscar, welcome to you both. Tensions in the Trump White House are continuing to rise as questions mount over whether the president or his team colluded with Russia during the US election. Let's consider for a moment the timeline of recent revelations. Last Monday, the Washington Post reported that President Trump asked his top intelligence officials to help him push back against the FBI investigation into possible collusion between his campaign and the Russian government. On Tuesday, former CIA Director John Brennan gave congressional testimony stating there was clear contact between Trump campaign aides and Russian operatives. On Wednesday, it was reported that a secret document officials say played a key role in former FBI Director James Comey's handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation has long been viewed as unreliable and possibly fake. On Thursday, news breaks that the president's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is under FBI scrutiny. And by Friday, it all gets even worse after it's revealed that Kushner tried to set up a backdoor communication channel with a Russian ambassador to avoid US surveillance. Jacob, thankfully it was the weekend, so not much broke over there, but that's quite a week, isn't it?
It has to go into the running for worst week in Washington in the last 20, maybe 30 years. I mean, you have to sort of step back from all of this and look at what is happening to the Trump administration and, you know, where this is all going. Because if we sort of step away from whatever suppositions or interpretations we have and say there are two possibilities. One is that there's some wrongdoing at the heart of this, and two, that there's not any wrongdoing at the heart of this. In either of those cases, I find it really hard to believe that this is being handled well by the administration. Everything they do, every way they push back, seems to only increase the scrutiny and increase the pace at which these sort of blockbuster stories, things that would be weeks of news in a more placid, calm time, are coming out. And it's so fast at this point that you can hardly, even if you do this professionally, and if your job is sort of Trumpology, if you will, you know, keeping all this straight and keeping these revelations sort of in a context where you can actually manage them and sort of put them alongside each other and frame it all in your mind is actually very difficult.
Oscar, is that the swiftness of the news cycle, the Trump news cycle in particular, makes this incredibly hard to keep a handle on? It's, you know, have most people forgotten, you know, how James Comey was fired and what he said and all the different excuses they came up with, and then the fact that in the end he essentially admitted to the Russians that it was because that he was being investigated by Comey himself? But we've moved on from that. We're now talking about Jared Kushner.
I mean, you begin to wonder if this is exactly what they want. Our heads are spinning. Now we're all wonder what Mr. Kushner was doing with Russian banker Sergei Gorkov. But as we heard before, if we step back, the question is, where is this all going? And I struggle to see whether even if there was wrongdoing on behalf of the Trump campaign, whether this is going to lead to articles of impeachment or some sort of constitutional way in which to weaken or the presidency of Mr. Trump or got rid of him. I mean, it doesn't seem to be the case that the Republican Party in particular is ready to do that. We listened to Senator John McCain, but others such as Paul Ryan and others who have so much responsibility on this are not saying much. I mean, the Republicans seem wedded to the idea that Trump must continue so that they don't lose power.
But what's important, Jacob, to remember is that at least there are two fairly proper investigations currently underway. One in the Senate, there's an intelligence committee in the Senate that is looking into all these allegations. And unlike the one in the House, it seems to be run by a Republican Democrat who both seem to be interested in getting to the truth. And then, of course, there's the special counsel, Robert Mueller III, who was appointed by the Deputy Attorney General, who, you know, by all accounts, appears to be an independently minded fellow.
The problem for all of this is that there's a profusion of investigations and that the scope seems to be expanding rather than contracting. You know, if you're looking at this from the perspective of the Trump administration and you're looking to sort of contain the damage, what you want to know is that they're sort of focusing down the investigation. They're picking on some individual who can be sort of safely tossed overboard. If they can pin the whole thing on, you know, Paul Manafort, say, and say, oh, yeah, Paul had these sketchy connections. We realized that. We fired him as campaign manager. Push him overboard. That's a survivable scandal. The problem is that every string that the investigators are pulling on seems to sort of raise up three or four new strings. And I think it was Norman Mailer who said about the CIA's sort of unwillingness to cooperate into the investigations of JFK's death. It wasn't that they were necessarily involved in JFK's death. It's that they were involved with so many people whose precise interpretation and involvement they didn't actually know themselves. They just didn't want anything to do with the investigation in the first place because they didn't want to know what they had implicitly been involved in. I think that's the real danger for Trump, is that, you know, there are a lot of financial dealings that Trump has, by dint of being a private businessman, not having a publicly traded company, has not had to sort of answer for publicly, and he never released his tax returns. There could be a lot of stuff in there that we just, you know, at minimum would look really bad for him. And the more these investigations proliferate,
but
the more chance.
Does that matter? I want to get onto this a bit more detail in a moment, but Jake, does that matter if it looks bad for him? Almost everything that's happened since before he took office, since when he was campaigning, has looked bad for him. He was on tape boasting about sexually assaulting women. That looked bad for him, and he was still elected president.
Yeah, of course it matters. I mean, this, you know, the idea that Trump is invincible relies on the fact that he won a very, very, what is historically an incredibly narrow election. He lost the popular vote. If you flip 77,000 votes in three states, or if you draw county line, I mean, there are various ways that you can sort of just tweak things slightly, and Trump doesn't actually win the election, without getting into the whole debate over, you know, the causation of the way the election went that it did. Anyways, the fact is that, you know, Trump has very low approval ratings by historical standards. He's at 41%, I think, this morning. And, you know, he's very focused on his base. He's very focused on getting out the people who really support him to gain re-election in 2020 and have a chance of getting his legislative agenda through. But the more he loses the sort of strong support, the more he cuts into independents' willingness to actually go for him and, you know, actually turn out, then the less chance that is happening.
Oscar, you mentioned before about the fact that, you know, if he is going to be impeached or removed from office in some way, then there is a responsibility on Republicans, people within his own party, which nominally he leads, to take action. As you're saying, that looks unlikely at the moment. What's striking as well recently, and what, you know, some people have been talking about, is that how the number of people within the Republican establishment who are now complicit in this. So you had General H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, during this trip. You know, you speak to sensible Republicans and even lots of Democrats, and they'll say, oh, no, look, General McMaster, he's a good guy. He's sensible. He wrote this great book 10 years ago that everyone reads. It's like he's on it. You look at the quotes from McMaster from the past trip, and he's a Trumpite now.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, he's part of the problem that is, although we're all focusing on Trump, the story seems to grow bigger, not just about him, but also about those around him. And as I step back, for me, the real story is the extent to which the Republicans are involved in all of this. Yes, I mean, Trump is a head figure, as you just said. I think you can, you know, throw even more than the kitchen sink at him and he wouldn't care. But the real story is how the Republicans are wedded to this. Part of that is, you know, the will not to lose power. But one begins to wonder if the second element here is that many around them are deeply involved. And that's what we're beginning to see.
Jacob, Charlie Sykes is a conservative talk show host in the US who has spoken very eloquently in the last year or so about this right-wing echo chamber that he has been part of, and he realizes now how damaging it's been. He was talking today about how if Watergate had happened in today's media environment, he feels that Richard Nixon would never have been impeached because half the population wouldn't believe what was in the Washington Post, wouldn't believe what was on the nightly news. It wouldn't really matter. Do you share those worries, or do you think he's slightly exaggerating?
I think he's basically right. And I don't know the full context of what he said, so maybe he mentioned this as well. But the other thing that's happened, and I think it's sort of linked to, but also to a large degree independent of the media environment, is the extent to which there has been just a complete shift in the degree of polarization in the US. And that is a bipartisan phenomenon, but one that's more strongly accentuated in the Republican Party. You don't have moderate Republican senators anymore. You have maybe two who could sort of vaguely be called moderates, like Susan Collins. But, you know, they're not as, you know, if you look at the sort of voting intentions of Republican senators or voting behavior of Republican senators, at this point, the most liberal Republican senator is to the right of the most conservative Democrat. And that wasn't the case in the 70s. So you did have these sort of, you know, conservative Southern Democrats and moderate Northern Republicans, and you just don't have that anymore.
There is this issue, isn't there, Oscar, that for some conservatives in the US, conservatism has been what makes liberals mad. So it doesn't actually matter. It's not about having a specific set of values or ideas or principles. It's do the other guys hate it? And let's be honest, we don't just see this in America with how conservatives are. We see it in lots of other countries on both left and right. It's, you know, whether that's in Venezuela or it's here in the UK. It's, well, look, if the other guy said it, I'm against it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're looking at this completely changed political landscape in which neither principles, nor even policies, nor even pragmatism matters, but solely, you know, to create a figure of the enemy that's, you know, against whom somehow you look better to a really, you know, to a basis, a sector of the population. No matter how small or insignificant they may be, they become this echo chamber, and you can use that to booster your own political aims.
Jacob, I want to ask you about leaks, and it's, you know, everyone has, you know, an interest in this, and a view, depending on whether the leak that they read is, you know, something they agree with. But there were two things recently. One was obviously here in the UK, there was a lot of consternation that all the details of about the man who blew himself up in Manchester were given by the UK intelligence service to US intelligence services, who instantly leaked them to the press. And the other is Susan Hennessy, who the managing editor of the very influential lawfare blog in the US, was today saying, look, actually, when you look at intelligence leaks now, we need to start thinking about what the purpose of them is, because there are these investigations, formal investigations. If you have concerns, you can take them to these investigations. Are we seeing too much stuff from the intelligence community that is leaked now because they feel they can, because whatever concerns they might have had before about leaking have kind of gone out of the window?
I think leaking in general you know, it's like a lot of things in a democracy. In sort of moderation, it performs an important regulatory function. Not least, it prevents the emergence of sort of shadowy cabals and conspiracies, because if everyone involved in a conspiracy, and there have to be a number of people involved, you know, if no one can trust that what they're doing will be kept secret, it makes it much more difficult to execute a conspiracy. And that, in general, I think is healthy for democracy. That said, there's a flip side to that, which is when you get into a culture of leaking, when you sort of establish that it's acceptable to leak details of ongoing investigations, of sort of private conversations, when you create the culture, and I think I'm actually taking from the thick of it here, the culture of leaking, yet another way in which the thick of it sort of prefigured modern politics, it's really dangerous, because you can't have, you know, you do need confidential discussions to carry out successful negotiations. You do need confidentiality to carry out investigations, and leaking as a general practice undermines that.
One final question to you both on this topic before we move on. We mentioned Watergate before, and that had, you know, in the end, a very clear conclusion. The president was going to be impeached. He resigned. There is no sort of story now of like, well, really, was it that bad? It's a very cut and dried thing. Oscar, do you think we could have a similar cut and dried ending here, which everyone agrees, yes, there was an investigation and they got to the truth, and then either Trump was exonerated or Trump had to resign, and we all agree this was the right thing?
I'm afraid not. I mean, everything we have discussed points towards a different conclusion, that actually is very likely that Trump will limp until the end of his current period, and he might even be reelected. That has to do precisely with what has happened to the news cycle, what is happening to our trust in truth and truthfulness, and also the fact that politics has been hijacked. So unless the population as a whole recovers a sense of their own political power, it's going to be very difficult to see those clear-cut results again.
Yeah, I basically agree with Oscar. I mean, I think unless there is an absolutely unambiguous, clear-cut, you know, clear-cut instance of illegality, and I think it would have to be unambiguous. It would have to be something like tax evasion, something that there's just no dispute about. And even then, there would be a solid 25% of the population, in the same way that there's 25% of the population that believed incredibly strongly that Barack Obama was a Kenyan-born Muslim socialist. 25% of the population would believe the IRS and the FBI conspired to unseat President Trump.
Okay, we'll move on. Deputy foreign ministers from Germany, France, Ukraine and Russia met in Berlin today to discuss possible ways to bring peace to Ukraine's east. Spokesperson said the discussions focused on the current situation on the ground with regard to the ceasefire and commitments under the Minsk agreement. But with much of the world concerned about Russia's meddling elsewhere, is peace in Ukraine falling further down the list of priorities? Oscar, it is, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what is interesting about this story, if you read it sideways, as it were, is to see both Merkel and Macron kind of coming together. Macron was talking about this yesterday and late last week, and trying to revive the Normandy format and see how, talks could happen. And you begin to wonder, is this the beginning of a sort of European foreign policy away from the necessary dependence on the US and Russia? Perhaps. If that's the case, then this would be interesting. If not, then, okay, let's wait and see. Because at the beginning of May, we were, the rumors coming from Kiev, where the Minsk II is not going to be implemented at all. Now we're hearing from Macron and Merkel, let's try to implement it. This will be good news for the Russians. But we need to wait and see what happens.
It was striking, wasn't it, Jacob, to see Emmanuel Macron's press conference with Vladimir Putin earlier this week, where he was quite happy about standing next to Putin and talking about what RT, what Sputnik tried to do by spreading propaganda during the election. He called them out as essentially propaganda outfits rather than journalistic outfits. And he made clear to President Putin that France was going to be robust when it came to what it saw as Russia's indiscretions.
Macron has a couple of advantages here. One is that he has very recently been elected and very recently sworn in. And he comes to this with sort of not only a significant, not massively overwhelming, but a significant majority of the French people having voted for him, but also with the sort of the goodwill of all pro-Europeans. And he hasn't, there hasn't been a chance for that to sort of dissipate yet. So he has this sort of temporary political capital. And he also comes from it having been elected in 2017 rather than 2016. So he has the experience of the last year plus the last few years of sort of escalating Russian involvement in Europe in one way or another to look back on and to have the sort of the experience of that to affect how he responds. And you saw that with his campaign, how it sort of, you know, made a big public claim about having resisted Russian hacking, how it sort of spoofed the Russian hackers and won that particular fight. So I think that, you know, his behavior in the press conference was in keeping with that sort of, here's an opportunity for me to show that I'm standing up to the Russians.
And yet, Oscar, at the same time, both Macron, Merkel, indeed others in the West, are a little more cagey about what support they give to Ukraine's government now compared to how they might have been 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all know that those in power in Kiev are not necessarily, you know, the best fellows to be in bed with. There is also what you mentioned before, that this is not no longer a priority. Now the priorities as well, the very soul of the European Union is at stake here. And so it's not surprising that they're being more cautious. It was interesting to hear Macron's saying that, you know, he wanted the Minsk, the full implementation of the Minsk agreement, that this was the only way to de-escalate the conflict in eastern Ukraine. As I said, this is something that the Russians will like. So we see an interesting game beginning to play here.
Okay, let's move on. In the next 7 minutes, we're going to somehow cover Colombia and Panama. Let's start with Colombia, where the President Juan Manuel Santos says an agreement has been struck with FARC rebels to extend a disarmament deadline by 20 days. Under a peace agreement signed late last year, all weapons had to be surrendered to the UN by Tuesday. The president noted that the change does not in any way affect the firm decision and clear commitment of the government and the FARC to comply with the accord. Oscar, this is a mere blip, is it?
President Santos may be a bit disingenuous here, and we're not hearing the full story. The rumors are that there are problems with implementations of the agreement. The government's plan seems not to be going according to plan, as it seems to happen so often these days. But there was also another very, you know, big piece of bad news for the government and peace in Colombia: the Constitutional Court's decision to, declare void the procedure used by the Colombian Congress to, legitimate this implementation. That's still neither here nor there. And of course, the reaction from the FARC was, okay, if this is void, we have to stop and think. And two things are very important now. Number one, whether all the weapons will go as quickly as they have been going. I mean, the procedure of disarmament was working. But now, one of the issues has to do with where the fighters are going to go. And that's there are no clear solutions here. So in a sense, the FARC are calling the government to account.
Jacob, this was always going to be messy, though, wasn't it? Because you were never going to have a situation where, yeah, if two-thirds of FARC gave up their weapons and truly disarmed, most people would see that as a success.
I think you'd struggle to find a peace accord, especially a peace accord signed in the wake of a conflict that has been going on for as long as the conflict between the Colombian government and FARC, where, you know, everything just sort of happened according to the original plan, where every single weapon was turned in, where, you know, there was no violations on either side. So, you know, I'm willing to, and with Oscar's very sort of wise sort of caveats in mind, I'm willing to give it a little bit of a chance to sort of, that this is just a hiccup, that this is, you know, not going to interfere with the ultimate progress, because I think, you know, this is complicated, and rebel groups aren't, they're not hierarchies. Even rebel groups as long-running and sort of established as the FARC, there are offshoots, there are, you know, subgroups, there are sub-commanders who aren't as keen as others.
And there are bigger problems here. I mean, the paramilitaries seem to be filling in the vacuum left by FARC, and that's a real, real issue.
And also, Oscar, I mean, it's really easy for us thousands of miles away to sit around this very nice table and talk about how, well, you know, these things are complicated and not everyone's going to disarm anyway and there are always going to be blips. In Colombia itself, do you get the sense that there is enough goodwill from enough people to see this process through, you know, any more blips in the future?
Opinion is divided. I would say that the majority do want this process to come to, you know, to the best result. But there are others, you know, led by ex-president Uribe and those on the far right, who really want to, you know, use this again as a political weapon to, you know, bolster their own aims.
Okay, finally today, he was once regarded as the audacious dictator of Panama and for a time played a key role for the United States in its battle against drug cartels. Manuel Noriega gave himself a promotion in 1983, as you do, becoming Panama's leader. From machete-wielding speeches and cocaine parties to secret passport deals with Fidel Castro and eventually international prison sentences for murder and corruption, it was perhaps Noriega's reputation for switching sides that ultimately led to his downfall. By 1989, he was ousted by American troops. He died late yesterday in Panama City, aged 83. How is he likely to be remembered, Oscar?
Oh, he was a son of a bitch, but he was my son of a bitch. You remember that, you know, attributed to Henry Kissinger and others. He was the very embodiment of that sort of U.S. foreign policy that's still around and is a total failure. Mind you, I remember very well feeling very angry when the U.S. Invaded Panama. I was very, very young back then. But perhaps I was really angry about the fact that they were using Van Halen to get Van Halen's Panama to get Noriega out of there. Noriega played a crucial role in the Iran-Contra scandal that remains very shady to this day. You know, if you read, and I invite our listeners to read two obituaries of Noriega, the one published in the New York Times and then the other one published in Le Monde, and you see the difference between the two of them and you begin to have a better picture of who Noriega was. He was not just playing both sides. He was a stooge. He was created by the U.S. School of the Americas. He was that man. He was the CIA's man in Panama. And then, as you do, he turned against them.
And Jacob, you know, people will say, well, look, you know, that's not how America does things these days. Things have changed. And maybe to a degree that's true. But, you know, this was certainly the way that America tried to run its backyard, certainly in the 70s and 80s.
The way the U.S. approached Latin America, I think, was very inflected by the Cold War, even if the extent of actual Soviet sort of operations within Latin America was significantly overstated by American politicians. So I think you wouldn't necessarily see something that heavy-handed. It also happened, and the Panama invasion in 89 has been sort of overlooked because it came between the initial sort of post-Vietnam American military operations in Grenada and Lebanon and the sort of the Gulf War, the U.S. goes in with a massive international coalition, wins a resounding victory with almost no casualties. So Panama kind of gets lost in that shuffle. And with it, I think Noriega, I mean, to the question of how it'll be remembered, I think Noriega is going to have to be content with his brief appearance in Call of Duty Black Ops 2, where other sort of Reagan-era drug war villains get a more nuanced portrayal in history.
There we are. Okay, on that unexpected note, we'll leave it. Jacob Parakilis and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Yolene Goffin and Christian Radev. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 1900, it's our design show, Section D. Do tune in to that. And of course, more on the day's top news stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. That is 1700 if you're listening on the East Coast. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.